You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we'll zoom in on the maps that gardeners use to find out when it's safe to plant stuff after winter's over. And we'll find out how climate change could impact these hardiness zone maps. First, when we move to a new place, most of us would like to get to know our neighbors. But actually doing that can be tricky or maybe awkward. When our next guest moved from Milwaukee to Appleton, he made it happen by arranging a party for his whole neighborhood. The Unity in the Community Block Party, which has grown to include community resource groups, is happening for the third straight year now on July 27th in Appleton's Hart Park. We also want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you know your neighbors? If you don't, do you wish you did? If you do, how did you go about making those connections? Are there block parties or community get-togethers in your part of the state? Does it make life better to know the people around you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Eric Allen is the founder and president of Sold Out Ministries, S-O-U-L-E-D, Out Ministries in Appleton, and opportunity coordinator at Appleton East High School. He started the Unity in the Community Block Party. Eric, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, there you were, Eric, in a new neighborhood, a new city in Appleton. What were you thinking as you thought, hey, I'm new here, I don't know anybody?
That's right, yeah. My daughter, daughter Kimora, which is our youngest, would play with a lot of kids on the block, and they would actually have a good time, but there was a disconnect between the parents. We never got a chance to meet the parents, didn't know who the parents were. So me and my wife thought, hey, what a great idea to just go knock on doors and see who's here and see what we can do to get to know our neighbors. So after that, me and my wife, we just went door to door, got a petition going to see if we can get the street blocked off. You know, of course, a lot of neighbors were, you know, in agreeance to some. Even that wasn't home at the time, they actually signed a petition, and we got it going. Got the streets blocked off, and the neighbors came out. They barbecued. We just had a great time. We had bounce houses. The Appleton Fire Department, they were there. Quick Trip, they gave some donations. It was a huge event.
Why was it so important for you to get to know the neighbors?
Well, for me, it was real important because we were actually living on the same block. So we wanted to not so much to start a neighborhood watch group, but, you know, we wanted to be in contact, in tune with what was going on the block, any community happenings, events, and things like that. And I think it's important that we engage with those that we're staying around. So then that way we'll be able to look out for one another, especially our children.
Eric, I'll admit, I'd probably be a bit shy about doing this. You know, I wouldn't just go up to people or go door to door and introduce myself and try to get something like that together. What would you say to people who are in my boat? How do we overcome that?
I would say just do it. Be like Nike, just do it. I'm a people person. I love to interact with people. I love to talk with people. I love to fellowship. I love to eat. So I would say a person that's kind of shy, just kind of hang out in the area just a little bit, you know, hey, water some grass, cut some lawns, or see, you know, what you can do to help beautify the block at first, and then let it go from there.
Talking to Eric Allen from Appleton about his efforts to get to know his neighbors, in part by starting the Unity in the Community Block Party, going into its third year now. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you done something like this to get to know your neighbors? Are you in a place where you don't know your neighbors? How do you feel about that? Or are you in a place where you feel like, yeah, everybody does know everybody and it feels pretty good? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Eric, year three, and this thing is growing, right?
Yes, it is. It's growing. We actually moved off the block. Me and my wife, we're in the process now, still home shopping, and I tell you, it is something. Mm-hmm. We actually moved off the block, and we outgrew the block, and we moved it to Manassas Hart Park. So this year, last year was a huge success. Unfortunately, we got a little rain, so the turnout wasn't as big, but it was still nice. This year, we thought maybe why don't we include the nonprofit organizations? Because after talking with a lot of families, doing a lot of community events, and working with scholars here in the schools, a lot of parents don't know about all the resources that they have readily available to them in the community. And so we've been reaching out to different organizations, and we've been getting a lot of people thinking it's a great idea. And so far, we got a number of people aboard so far.
Eric, hang on the line with us. I want to bring in a caller now. Sharon is with us in Appleton. Sharon, hi.
Hi. Yeah, we started this about 5 years ago.
Hello.
Hi. Excuse me, I'm at a bank right now. There we go. Yeah, about 5 years ago, we live in an older neighborhood because we are older. And that doesn't mean anything. But so I just decided I wanted to get to know people, put together a flyer, handed it out to about 30 of our neighbors. And we hosted the first year, and we had about 85% of
wow.
people show up. And it was great.
And now do you feel like, you know, you go out on the street, you see the neighbors, these are people you know now, having made that first step with them, Sharon?
Oh, yeah. It's been huge. It's been huge. And every year it expands. We have three of us now that host. We kind of rotate it through. Sometimes we do it in the winter, sometimes in the summer, sometimes both. And it's just made a whole difference in the neighborhood. We've had people, like I said, it's an older neighborhood that have lived there for 40 to 50 years and just knew their immediate neighbors. And now they have, you know, they can go a whole couple blocks.
Sharon, that's fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. Eric, have you seen that in your community since you started Unity in the community? That feels like people know each other better now.
Yes, man. People look forward to it. They talk about how they enjoyed themselves, enjoyed the entertainment, just to see the kids interact with one another, other family members that come out. And they always asking, hey, is it going to be in the same spot next year, or where you having it this year? So it feels good to see that, especially when you're in your local neighborhood grocery stores and stuff like that. So, yeah, I like that.
Sharon, thanks a lot for sharing that story with us. You mentioned the kids. You know, the kids will just go out and play with other kids. We lose that when we're grown-ups, right? We just don't run out and play with Eric next door.
Right, yeah. And it was a chance for the adults to connect on a level that they had never connected on. We were doing some dancing out there, some little singing and things of that nature. And everybody got to share some of their favorite dishes. Some people prepared food in the home that they brought out. Others bought their barbecue grill out. We had lawn chairs. We just had a good time.
I want to bring in another caller. Gary is with us in Kaukauna. Gary, hi.
Yeah, good afternoon. I heard your program. I enjoy this because somebody encouraged me one time. He said, you should write a book about the old neighborhood. I said, no, I'm not qualified to do that. But I grew up in the 40s, 50s, and so forth, and we had a great neighborhood. It wasn't Listeria Way, but it was there were a lot of different people that had different issues, but everybody got along, and they pulled in the same direction. In fact, two of the neighbors had boats, and they would take all the parents out on a Friday night to go for a fish fry at a local yacht club. And the kids later on, because they would have a block party, would have to shuck the corn and put it in the tanks because one of the neighbors had a corn lot. And we ate the corn and so forth, and they had a big party. And every night at midnight when they had the party, one of the neighbors would bring out a shotgun. This is in the city, of course.
Oh, good. Okay.
And he'd shoot the shotgun out, and everybody enjoyed that.
I got you, Gary. Just a minute or so left with Eric. I don't know about shooting off the shotgun at midnight, but I hear in Gary, and probably you hear this from people, kind of a hunger. Like, hey, I wish my neighborhood was like this, where people would get together like this. What do you think, Eric?
What's that?
That do you get a sense that a lot of people are hungry for these kind of neighborhood get-togethers like Gary had and like you created?
Oh, definitely. Most definitely. I think a lot of people respond well to it when it's happening. Like you said, a lot of people just don't know how to make that connection or don't know how to make that interaction with their neighbor. So they wait in the background and they lean and depend on stuff like this. So they look forward to it, I think. They look forward to it.
In our last few moments, Eric, can you give a pep talk to somebody who maybe thinks, yeah, I want this, but I don't know. Am I the person to do it?
Yeah, I would say if you're thinking about it, then you're the person to do it. you are. And the best way to start is with your neighbor and see what your neighbor thinks about it. And then, hey, I say grab a couple kids like we did and just go for it. It's hard to resist the little ones when they're with you.
Eric, thank you so much for telling us about this. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you for having me.
That's Eric Allen, president of Sold Out Ministries in Appleton, the founder of the Unity in Community Block Party that's happening this year on July 27th at Hart Park. You can still share your stories. Have you gotten to know your neighbors? How did you do it? Did it just sort of happen or did somebody make it happen? Was that somebody you? You can email ideas@WPR.org right now and tell us about it or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up, we'll talk about what hardiness zone maps are, how gardeners use them, how they're made, and how they could be impacted by a changing climate. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Trump is threatening to put new tariffs on Mexican imports unless Mexico does more to limit immigration into the U.S. We'll talk about the reaction from Mexico and from Republicans in Congress. First, when it comes to deciding when to start planting your garden for the season, hopefully you've done a lot of that already, some of you might just trust your gut. Others might look at hardiness zone maps to see when it's planting time. Central Time producer Dean Knetter talked to WisContext editor Will Cushman about what those maps are, how they're made, and how climate change might affect them.
Before we get into how these maps are drawn, what exactly do we mean when we talk about a hardiness zone?
Right. So, and that's an important distinction because I think a lot of people do often get confused about what the USDA hardiness zones can tell us. And essentially, all they can tell us is whether or not a perennial can reasonably be expected to survive in our region. So the zones are split into, I think there's about roughly a dozen zones in the United States. And each one of them is where, is delineated by, 10 degrees, they go down into half zones where it's 5 degrees. But these broad regions where the extreme low temperature in the winter is averaged out. And within that region, the extreme low temperature is expected to be like usually in a given year around that temperature. So that gives you a good sense of whether or not the perennial that you want to plant will be able to survive a winter. Like sometimes, again, these are averages. So sometimes you'll have a warm winter where a perennial that maybe you shouldn't have planted in Wisconsin does survive. Don't expect it to in subsequent years. It could. But on the flip side, you might have a year where something that you would normally expect to survive in southern Wisconsin or even northern Wisconsin might not survive because of a really intense cold snap. And so the USDA hardiness zones, they're averages of cold weather extremes. They're not necessarily the coldest temperature.
And who tends to be interested in these maps and use them?
They were originally made for farmers as well as horticulturists. A lot of people who use them anymore are home gardeners, hobbyists. I think probably some farmers will still use them if they're maybe thinking about planting some perennial crop. Usually that's going to be something like an orchard crop, like a stone fruit crop or something like that, not necessarily one of your annual crops. But for the most part, it is home gardeners that I think use it the most.
And what kind of zones do we see across Wisconsin?
Yeah. In Wisconsin, we have three broad zones ranging from zone 3 up in the northwestern part of the state, kind of centered around Hayward, down to zone 5, which is in the southern part of the state and then also hugs the Lake Michigan shore line pretty much up through Door County. And those zones, so in zone 3, 3B is what's in northwestern Wisconsin. I think the average low extreme temperature that you can expect in the winter is around negative 40 degrees, versus zone five is going to be a little bit warmer, like 20 to 30 degrees warmer, average extremes.
Now, there have been three big iterations of the hardiness zone map from the USDA. The first came in 1960, and there was another in 1990. How was the data for these maps originally compiled?
Right. So the USDA has been, or the federal government has been tracking climate data, weather data at thousands of weather stations across the United States, basically since the 19th century, late 19th century in a lot of locations. And they people decided in kind of the mid 20th century to harness that data and look at the averages of winter cold extremes to try to give guidance to farmers and to gardeners. And so that's what the 1960 map did. They essentially averaged, I think it was a few decades of winter low extremes at each weather station in this network. And they basically just connected the dots between weather stations where the average extremes were fell within the same 10 degree range, and so it wasn't super spatially detailed, but it did give people kind of a good sense of regions that experience similar climates, at least cold extreme climates.
We're talking with Will Cushman right now, associate editor at WisContext, about how we map hardiness zones that provide guidance to gardeners and farmers. You can read more and see some of these maps over at wiscontext.org. And Will, in 2012, the USDA released another version of the map that addressed some limitations with those earlier versions. What was different about this new map?
The new map used algorithms, which I will not try to go into too much detail about because I don't know myself what all went into developing those algorithms. But I do know, so in the 1960 and 1990 iterations, they basically just averaged the extreme low temperatures at a given weather station and connected the dots. In 2012, they incorporated this algorithm that also incorporated a lot of other things that are known to affect a local climate, and including winter extreme temperatures, those being elevation, latitude, and then also proximity to large bodies of water. That's why we see Lake Michigan, the Zone 5 going all along the shoreline of Lake Michigan up through Door County, even mm-hmm. though Zone 4 creeps down a lot farther south in the interior of Wisconsin. And there are a bunch of other parameters that also affect a local climate and extreme low temperatures that just couldn't really be incorporated just by averaging the extreme low temperatures that were recorded in weather stations.
And looking at these maps, these three maps that now span 50 plus years, what kind of changes have we seen in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so interestingly, the 1990 map actually showed USDA hardiness zones that were a little bit colder almost across the board in the United States, including Wisconsin, than had been shown in 1960. And what I learned was that the 1990 maps actually used only about 14 years of weather data in the 70s and 80s, and it was actually a period of particularly cold winters that were colder than average. And so the USDA maps reflected that. They showed that the zones were maybe a little bit colder than they otherwise would be expected to be if you used a longer data set. And so that's why in 2012, they returned to these longer data sets. They're called climate normals. They're 30-year data sets. So it's usually like 1971 through 2000 or 1981 through 2010. The 2012 maps used 1975 through 2006 or something like that, I believe, but kind of like straddled those two climate normals.
And have we seen climate change affecting these hardiness zones?
So in talking to the developer of the 2012 maps, Christopher Daly at Oregon State University, he's the one who developed the algorithm for these maps. He and the USDA actually officially are they caution against interpreting changes in the USDA zone maps as evidence for climate change, essentially because of the changes in methodology that were used. They said that the changes in the zones that we see are more a reflection in the changes in the methodology, and in fact, in particular, the incorporation of this algorithm in 2012. And not only did it provide a lot more spatial detail, but it used a longer data set. But at the same time, NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, developed its own hardiness zone maps around 2012. I think it was in like 2011. And they used two climate normals, the first being the 70s through 2000 and the second being the 80s through 2010. And they showed that there indeed does seem to be a creep in the USDA or in the hardiness zones going north. What they showed was that including in Wisconsin, there seems to be a little bit of creep north in these hardiness zones, which would reflect a warming climate.
Will, as we wrap up, with climate change throwing a lot of temperatures and weather patterns into some flux, what is the future of these hardiness zone maps and how they're put together?
Yeah, Christopher Daly, the guy who developed the 2012 map, said he's hopeful that USDA will ask him to develop more maps in the future. He would like to see it done every 5 years, more so that there isn't necessarily like a vacuum. People don't start going elsewhere to try to figure out like what perennials to plant in their backyard. But also there is the expectation both at NOAA and I think at USDA that in the long term, as there are more maps made that follow the same methodologies, that those maps will continue to reflect a changing climate. And the expectation is that the hardiness zones will continue their northward march.
We'll leave it there. Will, thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
That was Central Time producer Dean Kinetter talking to Will Cushman, the associate editor at WisContext, about his recent look at hardiness zones for gardeners. You can learn more about the maps in his piece online over at wiscontext.org. Coming up after the news, President Trump is putting more tariffs on Mexican imports in an effort to curb immigration into the U.S. We'll find out how members of Congress are responding in our weekly look at the latest news in national politics. Plus, we'll take a look at some new platforms on climate change coming from a growing number of Democratic candidates for president. And our question for you this week: is this something you want to see from your presidential candidate? Do you want to see them have a plan when it comes to climate change? What kind of things would you like to see in that plan, if so? You can get started. Email ideas@WPR.org. It's the Weekend Washington coming up. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, lawmakers on the state's budget writing committee had their first vote yesterday on state Medicaid funding. We'll find out what happened and learn about a new partnership among state agencies to boost enrollment in health plans. First, it's time for our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. President Trump continues to threaten new tariffs on Mexican imports unless the country does more to stem immigration into the U.S. The White House is ordering former aides to defy congressional subpoenas, and presidential candidates Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren both rolled out proposals this week aimed at fighting climate change, joining other candidates in the field. Our question for you this week: does it matter to you whether a presidential candidate has a plan to address climate change? If so, what do you want to see in those plans? Are there concerns you have about the country, your area, maybe your line of work, and how it might be affected by climate change? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Lauren Gambino is a political correspondent for The Guardian. Lauren, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's start with this idea of tariffs on all imports from Mexico starting at 5%, working their way up. That'd start in about a week. The goal to pressure the country to limit immigration to the U.S. Here's a listen to what the president had to say.
Mexico shouldn't allow millions of people to try and enter our country, and they could stop it very quickly. And I think they will. And if they won't, we're going to put tariffs on. And every month, those tariffs go from 5% to 10% to 15% to 20 and then to 25%. And what will happen then is all of those companies that have left our country and gone to Mexico are going to be coming back to us. And that's okay.
Do we have an indication of the actual benchmarks President Trump would use to remove these tariffs?
Well, he says he's very serious about the tariffs, first and foremost, but he said that he would not impose them if Mexico would stop allowing Central American immigrants to cross the border from Mexico into from Guatemala into Mexico and then, you know, make their way up to the U.S. border. So he really wants Mexico to, you know, get much more serious, in his words and his view, about immigration. He also wants them to keep asylum seekers trying to enter the U.S. on their side of the border. But it does remain unclear exactly, you know, what those numbers would look like, if it's even feasible for Mexico to accomplish this in the timeline. He's, you know, threatening tariffs next week. So could they, you know, feasibly get this into place fast enough? So there's a lot of question marks about it. And it really isn't clear exactly what those benchmarks are.
What have we heard from leadership in Mexico itself?
So Mexico is actually, they seem to be taking a deep breath. They've obviously been dealing with this administration on issues of immigration now for a long time. Well, this is a new government in Mexico, a relatively new government, but, you know, Mexico is now kind of used to Trump threatening to build a wall on the border. You know, they're sort of used to this, the threats. So it does seem like they're taking a very measured approach. They obviously do not want these tariffs to be put into place. And so it looks like they're going to try to strike an agreement. We have top leaders from the U.S. and Mexico, you know, discussing the issue today and this week. And those talks are expected to continue in earnest to try to avoid this.
Some top Republicans have been responding to this tariff threat. Here's a listen to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell on the issue.
I think I can safely say most of us hope that this Mexican delegation that's come up here and discuss the challenges at the border and what the Mexicans might be able to do to help us more than they have will be fruitful, and that these tariffs will not kick in.
And there's been more angry response from other Republicans, not quite so measured there. What have we seen from in the range of Republican congressional reaction?
So they have a lunch meeting every Tuesday, and they came out of that meeting yesterday just fuming. None of them want this. This is, you know, very contrary to, you know, to their traditional Republican values. It is pretty remarkable because most Republicans are with the president on immigration. They want stricter immigration controls, and they want, you know, more security at the border. But he has found the one way to really drive a wedge on the issue of immigration, and that's by bringing tariffs into this. So, yeah, most Republicans, especially in the Senate, are very opposed to this idea. There are some, you know, who are trying to sort of find a way, you know, who say he has the right to do this, but, you know, they don't totally agree with it. But I think the prevailing opinion is that this is a very bad idea. It, you know, risks undermining a separate trade negotiations that they are, you know, have renegotiating NAFTA with Mexico and Canada. And it also, you know, risks hurting the economy, which is what Republicans and Donald Trump plan to run on in 2020.
We're talking to Lauren Gambino from The Guardian, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. The White House is instructing two former presidential aides, Annie Donaldson and Hope Hicks, to defy subpoenas from the House Judiciary Committee. What are lawmakers looking for in these subpoenas?
So Democrats really want to hear more from them about, you know, specifically what they witnessed in relation to possible obstruction of justice. They want, I mean, these, especially in the case of Hope Hicks, you know, she's someone who was really just a constant presence by the president's side for as long as she worked in the White House, and obviously prior to that on his campaign. So she was very close to the president. She, you know, saw and worked with him in a very close capacity. So they believe that she would offer insight and perhaps more clarity on these issues that Robert Mueller outlined in his report relating to obstruction of justice. And, you know, part of it is also just getting these White House and former White House officials before their committee on television so that you've got this, you know, what Republicans call a spectacle, but you've got them talking on TV about these instances of obstruction of justice, because Democrats realize most Americans haven't read the full Mueller report. And this would be a very compelling way to sort of lead the public through that report.
And this also happened, something similar happened with former White House lawyer Don McGahn. Are you expecting to see a lot more of this? Democrats in the House want to talk to someone. The White House says no, and we have these standoffs now that we're in a post-Mueller investigation world.
Absolutely. Trump and the White House have vowed to deny all subpoenas from, you know, the Democratic-controlled House. They want to put this behind them, and their strategy is to, you know, to use obstruct. They really do not want Democrats poking around and drawing this out. They believe, you know, the spectacle of having these nationally televised hearings would draw comparisons perhaps to Watergate, and, you know, this could lead perhaps sway more Americans towards the idea of impeachment, you know, if they go poorly for Trump and his officials and former officials. So, you know, I mean, so far this is their strategy. It's Democrats have threatened to take some of these defiances to court. Obviously, in the case of, you know, William Barr, they're threatening the Attorney General. They're threatening to hold him in contempt of court. In contempt of Congress. And so, you know, it's kind of now Democrats' choice how they really handle this and how, you know, how far they're willing to escalate this showdown.
And you mentioned impeachment. Speaker Nancy Pelosi is saying the president is engaged in a cover-up, but isn't herself calling for impeachment proceedings. Different opinions on among Democrats whether they want to start proceedings, have an impeachment inquiry, continue with committee investigations. What are you seeing? What's the latest on that range of options?
So I think you're starting to see, you're definitely seeing more presidential candidates come out in favor of impeachment. We've saw several more candidates, lesser high profile than, you know, Elizabeth Warren and Kamala Harris. But we're seeing other candidates now come out in favor of impeachment. You're seeing more and more House members come around to the idea, and you're seeing some, some Democrats say, if we, our window for convincing people that we should be doing this is kind of closing. You know, if we wait and drag this out and we act like we really don't want to do this, but somehow get pushed into doing it, that doesn't look good for us. We need to be confident. We need to, you know, believe in the reasons for doing this. And we need to probably do that very quickly. So I think you're starting to see a tide turning among Nancy Pelosi's caucus, but she believes this is just very bad politics, especially going into an election year. She thinks it will only help Trump. And she's worried about, you know, her majority. She does not want to lose moderate members of the House because they decided to go for impeachment and ultimately, you know, believing that the Senate probably won't vote to convict the president. So what is it all for is sort of her case.
We're talking to Lauren Gambino, political correspondent for The Guardian, about some of the week's top political news. Coming up, we'll talk about climate change and the 2020 presidential race, and you can get in on the conversation now. What do you think about climate change as a campaign issue? Is it important to you that a candidate has a plan to address climate change? What would you want to see in that kind of plan? Or do you have worries about a big green energy initiative, as some of the candidates are talking about? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Lauren Gambino, political correspondent at The Guardian, looking at this week's news out of Washington. Well, let's turn to the presidential campaign, Lauren. Two Democratic candidates recently released proposals aimed at combating climate change. A couple of the big names here, former Vice President Joe Biden, Senator Elizabeth Warren. They're not the first to talk about climate change. What are we seeing in their plans?
They have both introduced these sweeping climate plans. They want to have the federal government heavily invest in combating climate change. They want to see much more investment in green energy. There's a much bigger focus on, Joe Biden's plan wants to eliminate the nation's net carbon emissions by 2050. And Elizabeth Warren's plan, she wants to create a National Institute of Clean Energy. So I think you're seeing very big and very bold proposals. And it's worth noting that these are two candidates who traditionally might fall on sort of separate sides of the Democratic ideology scale, if you will. But yet on climate change, their proposals are actually kind of in line with one another. Joe Biden was actually criticized just a few weeks ago by some very high-profile left liberal progressives. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez called him out and said, you know, this is not a time for middle-of-the-road politics. This is a major issue. And, you know, just weeks later, we see this climate plan from Joe Biden, and some progressives are taking a victory lap, saying we really pushed him on this issue because it is bold, and you are seeing progressive climate activists very supportive of it.
I want to bring on a caller now. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me on. I don't think people realize that the growth in population of two countries, India and China, are driving a lot of this. You could take the entire state of Wisconsin, every person, every business, put it on a planet or on a spaceship in outer space, and it wouldn't make a dent in our global warming of the Earth because of simply the population growth. We could be on that spaceship for 30 years, and the continued population growth will overcome any of the savings of us, of our use. We don't talk about it. Nobody cuts back on, the number of baseball games, the Indy 500, there's still 500 laps. We've got such a huge problem that the United States trying to go this alone it's not going to make any difference. Russia would love to have the Earth heat up because it would open up drilling in the Arctic for them, so they're not going to sign on for anything.
So, Mike, just briefly before I let you go, do you want to see a climate plan from candidates because it won't make a difference?
No.
Am I hearing you right?
No, it won't make a difference unless we're going to go nuclear. Somebody like Ortez, who's a bartender trying to talk about global warming and thinking that we're going to solve it. It's like the candidate in Madison that ran for Alder. He wanted to paint all the streets in Madison white.
Mike, thanks a lot for calling in. Lauren, not on board with a lot of many Democratic primary voters are looking for here.
That's true. We are seeing incredible polling that shows Democrats that this is suddenly a top-tier issue. Really, in past elections, that has not been the case. But for Democrats, they are really looking at climate change as an issue, and they're expecting their candidates to come out with these big proposals. But, to the caller's point, I think that was one of the big controversies over Donald Trump pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement that was meant to be this big global agreement. And, the idea was if the U.S. is not at the table, then that might allow other countries, China notably, to also, not agree to any terms. And, it takes the pressure, the U.S. maybe as a global leader or a leader on the international stage, them not being at the table does sort of, other countries might start to say, why should we, meet these big climate goals if the U.S. is not at the table. So I think there might be a significant there is a role for the U.S. to play, even though obviously population wise these countries are much bigger than us. But we certainly do have a role to play, I think, is the argument that many Democratic candidates would make.
And a lot of people point toward the per capita energy use in the U.S. as well.
Exactly. Yes, exactly.
Thanks a lot for the call, Mike, at 800-642-1234. And in the politics of this, we see at least one Democratic candidate, Washington Governor Jay Inslee, saying, I'm not just talking about climate change. I'm making climate change my number one issue. Lauren.
Yes, sorry. I thought you might play a clip. Yes, no, it's incredible. We've never seen a candidate run solely on climate change. He is approaching every issue, national security, even foreign policy. He wants to be driven by a climate policy interest. So, you know, that would include, again, some of what the caller was bringing up, this idea of everyone needs to be at the table. And, you know, we have, I guess it's from the point of view, this is a real crisis. All the experts are telling us, you know, we have so many years left to figure this out. So this needs to be our first priority. And it needs to be the sort of lens through which we approach every decision that, you know, that a president would have to make. Jay Inslee is, I think he's impressing a lot of climate activists with his plan. I don't know how broadly he's winning over the Democratic base. He's still not doing incredibly well in polling, but, you know, we do have the debates coming up, so a lot could change there. And who knows if this is truly the issue of this presidential primary, maybe that helps him take off or distinguishes him at least. And, you know, maybe worst case, he is able to sort of influence the debate with some of his ideas.
Talking to Lauren Gambino from The Guardian, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. We'll bring on another caller now. Rachel is with us in Fort Atkinson. Rachel, hi.
Hi. I'd like to see more presidential candidates talk about egg and the industry surrounding it, especially since we are from the Midwest and Wisconsin, the dairy land. I just wish we could focus in on our good old hometown stuff instead. I do appreciate the big aspects like climate change and stuff, but really focusing on egg industries.
Rachel, thanks for the call. And with Iowa early in voting, Lauren, we often see candidates talk about issues of interest in the agricultural community, right?
Yeah, I'm sure we'll hear a lot more about that in Iowa. And then obviously with Wisconsin being such a pivotal player because of what happened in 2016, maybe you'll hear a lot more of that and you'll hear a lot more candidates coming to Wisconsin much earlier, I would imagine.
Rachel, thanks for the call. Lauren, before we run out of time, I want to turn to this disaster relief plan passed now by the U.S. House, a $19 billion disaster aid package heading to the president for a signature. This had a rocky road. Can you talk about the path that got us here a little bit?
It has been a long time coming. Some of these disasters happened months and months ago. So there was basically a dispute with Trump and Congress over what should be in the bill. I mean, it's a massive aid bill, $19 billion. So Trump really was resistant to the idea of adding extra aid for Puerto Rico. He's obviously had some high-profile clashes with the leaders, some government leaders from the island, and so this was something that really bothered him. Eventually, more recently, he was able to get on board, but while members of Congress were on, while they were away over the Easter holiday, they thought that they would sort of be able to sail a piece of legislation through, and a couple Republicans single-handedly were able to block that bill. So they kind of had to wait until everyone was back in order to pass this week. So we are finally there. We've got now we finally have a bill that will reimburse these states and Puerto Rico for, you know, hurricanes, tornadoes, flooding, wildfires. I mean, so much has happened, and the devastation, obviously, with each of these crises kind of gets worse by the year. So the longer they took, the more they were having to cover, actually. So it ended up backfiring by drawing it out this long.
And we'll leave it there. Lauren, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Lauren Gambino, a political correspondent for The Guardian. She was with us for our weekly look at the ongoing stories in national politics. We still want to hear from you, though. We talked a little bit about global warming in the presidential campaign, heard a little bit about agriculture there, too. What we want to hear from you as campaign 2020 rolls on here in 2019, what do you want to hear candidates talking about? What do you want to hear their plans on? Is there an issue that stands out above all others that motivates you to vote, to donate to a candidate, to support them, to share them on social media. You can use all the ways to share your thoughts with us. You can email ideas@WPR.org. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Love to hear from you there. You can also send a message via the Ideas Network Facebook page. We want to hear from you, and we'll probably do a call-in on this before too much longer. What topic is the most important to you in the presidential race? Is it something like climate change? Is it trade and tariffs? Is it something closer to home like agriculture? What do you want the media to hold the candidates' feet to the fire on? Let us know which issues you are watching in presidential race 2020. Again, email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR or head over to Facebook, the Ideas Network Facebook page, and let us know what you think. There was a weird media convergence in Wisconsin this week. Step one, the singer and musician Rob Thomas is performing in the state on Friday. That Rob Thomas is best known for his work with the band Matchbox 20. Before his Wisconsin trip, Rob Thomas was interviewed by Rob Thomas. But not that Rob Thomas. This one is an entertainment writer for the Cap Times in Madison, who's been a guest on this show a time or two. So pretty cool, two guys with the same name having a chat. But then today on Twitter, they got a note from Rob Thomas. But not that Rob Thomas or the other Rob Thomas, but TV producer Rob Thomas, best known as the creator of the TV series Veronica Mars, which I think is getting a little bit of a comeback later this year. He tweeted, Rob Thomas number three, he'd probably say he's number one, why wasn't I invited to this interview? Now, this is all well and good for the Rob Thomases of the world, but what about the Rob Ferrets? This sort of thing doesn't come up too often for me. I think I've run across an English soccer player named Rob Ferret online once or twice. By accident. I never searched my own name online, of course. We'll go out with some music related to one of the Rob Thomases. But which one? This is Central Time.